ultimately did. Okay, I can't seem to get continue. Okay, got it. Okay.
All right. Yeah. Okay.
So we're, as we look at chapter one, the title, we can entitle it "Fulfilled Multiplication and Forced Eradication." That's a good way to kind of title this. The first seven verses deal with the promised increase. Verses 8 through 14, the first purge of the Jews. And then secondly, verses 15 through 22, the second purge that's attempted. And let's look at verses 1 through 7. Let's read them together. Starting in verse 1, now these are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt. Each man and his household came with Jacob. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Verse 3, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin. Verse 4, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. Verse 5, all those who were descendants of Jacob were 70 persons, for Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, all his brothers and all that generation, but the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. So the first seven verses here, the three prominent subjects of Exodus are God's plan for deliverance, God's guidance for morality, and God's order for worship, which we would not cover in this study, essentially. Another prominent fact that kind of governs the theology of Exodus is put forth just immediately here. Verses 1 through 7, it's a virtual commentary on the ancient promise made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that their seed would be as numerous as the stars of heaven and the sands of the sea. This is the Abrahamic covenant, as well as the Palestinian covenant, later specific land that they would be given. But in this particular case, it's the Abrahamic covenant. And we had mentioned this so many times in the book of Genesis. This is a basic covenant that the Lord has made with Abraham after we saw the confusion of the later chapters of Genesis, particularly Genesis 6 through 11, where we saw cataclysmic events, including angelic beings that had left their place and had, depending on how you look at it, either had relations with men or caused an enormous amount of havoc, and the flood occurs. A lot of commentators believe that these angelic beings instructed mankind on evil. I mean, man was already evil because of what Adam did, his evil, sinful nature, but I mean that they had played a role in increasing evil and such. It's just a speculation. And then, of course, chapter 11, where we saw the Tower of Babel, and God, because man would not scatter, God scattered for them. And so in the midst of all that chaos, God selects one man and makes a covenant with him, and then that covenant with his descendant and his descendant. And so that covenant, because it says in the scriptures, God could promise on no one greater than himself, swear on no one greater than himself. He swore upon his name that he would have this happen. And of course, as we see in the book of Romans, chapter 3, Paul asks the question, even if man is not faithful, does that make God unfaithful? And of course, the answer is absolutely not. God will see his promise fulfilled, and he will always have a faithful remnant. So another, as we can advance here, the slide, Moses, as we saw before, is intent on reminding his people of the promise again and again. Note that verses 1 through 4 virtually repeat Genesis 35, verses 22 through 26. Again, Moses is reminding the people again. Verse 5 is also a reiteration of Genesis 46, verse 27. Verse 6 of Genesis 50, verse 26. So these are common themes that we've seen before. And finally, verse 7 of Genesis 1, 28. So Moses then adds some features, new features, however. He makes reference to families or households in verse 1, and that's new, as was the fact that Joseph was treated separately from his brothers in verse 5, and so also was the notice in verse 6 that all that generation, along with Jacob's 12 sons, had died. So Exodus begins with a list of names and takes us to real places and biblical characters in the Near East. The sons of Jacob's wives, Leah and Rachel, are placed in order of their seniority ahead of the sons of his two concubines, except for Joseph. They are arranged in three groups. The first four sons of Leah, Genesis 29, 31 through 35, are linked together in verse 2. And the last two sons of Leah, again, referencing Genesis 30 here, after she had temporarily stopped bearing children, along with Benjamin, the second son of Rachel, are separated by an and here in verse 3. And the sons of the handmaid Bilhah and of the handmaid Zilpah are joined together here in verse 4 and how they're presented. The family list in Genesis 46 gives this total, going into great detail now. So it's the six men of Leah had 25 sons and two grandsons, totaling 33. The two sons of Rachel had 12 sons, totaling 14. Bilhah's two sons had 5 sons, contributing 7 to the sum. And finally, Zilpah's two sons had 11 sons, one daughter, added to the count here, and two grandsons, making 16. So in total, 33 plus 14 plus 7 give us, plus 16 give us the 70. I will say this right now, and I'm sure you've encountered this too. There are parts of the scripture that refer to 75 people going down to Egypt. The point of the matter is that a big group went down there, and they were the basis for the Israelites, a family, God making a covenant with one man, which becomes a family, which the family goes down to Egypt and then grows into a very, very large nation. And that's where we find yourself in Exodus 1. Finally, on verses 6 through 7, with the language of God's promised blessing of multiplication and increase, this is, it's given to Adam, it's given to Noah, it's given to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So this is a promise that God makes, and there is a reminder, again, of his fulfillment, his intent to fulfill this. So Moses recorded that God had been fulfilling this plan during the 430 years Israel was in Egypt. And we see in Exodus 3 that God had heard their cries of oppression, and God responded. But we find another part of scripture saying that he waited all of this time so that the pagan nations of Canaan would repent. This is how long-suffering the Lord is. Even though his own people suffered, God is that concerned that men and women would be given the chance, given the light level they had, to accept the Lord. His long-suffering is beyond anything that any of us could imagine. That's his heart. That's how big his heart is for his own creation. And that's our mighty God. It's incredible. So let's read the next set of verses here, next six verses, verses 8 through 14. I have the New King James here. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply and it happen in the event of war that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land." Verse 11, "Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. And the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were in dread of the children of Israel." So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar, in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. And their service in which they made them serve was with rigor. So the amount of time that has passed, it really indicates the fact that this current Pharaoh did not know the blessing that Joseph had been to the nation. This is a long time that has passed. He's really ignorant of this fact. He's more concerned about the threat, as he perceives, of this massive group of people that continue to multiply. Verses 9 to 10, Israel was called a people for the first time in verse 9. And so the situation was a difficult balance for Pharaoh. There are a lot of great commentaries on the Old Testament. Whitcomb does a great job, the Expositor's Bible Commentary, so many of them. But here is the situation. Pharaoh needed to maintain the Israelite presence as an economic asset. They were the engine of his economy without jeopardizing Egypt's national security. You know, if you read through the book of Kings, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, Chronicles, you find all these schemes, intrigues that go on. In this particular case here, Pharaoh, like the politician that he is, looks at this and has a difficult situation in his perception here. There are two storehouses mentioned, two cities. We have good archaeological evidence of their existence. It's interesting, if you ever read about biblical archaeology, it's estimated that only about 1% of biblical archaeology has been well-researched or well, I mean, archaeological digs have gone thorough. So we've got an enormous amount of archaeology to do yet. And in that 1%, we have, archaeologists have discovered quite an enormous amount of evidence for the existence of these things. And so it's just really thrilling if you think about it. But these two cities are well documented archaeologically. Verses 12 through 14, think about the response and this kind of lopsided, foolish, pharaic thinking. The king of Egypt said, "We've got to do something or they will become even more numerous." But the God of the universe said, the more they multiplied, the more he multiplied. So here's the situation. The more, it's very much like the devil in Acts. The more he tries to stamp out the church, the more he spreads, you know, the church throughout the world. In this particular case, the more that Pharaoh hammered down on the people, the more numerous they became. And the result was that a deep and frightening dread came over the Egyptians. This is the same thing that overtakes the king of Moab when he sees the nation of Israel organized in tribes. He's frightened. And God, of course, spread the dread of the Israelites as they continued their march into the land of Canaan. Ironically, in both cases, the God-intended instrument for the salvation of both nations came instead through the hardness of men's hearts, the source of crippling fear. I will curse, in other words, I will curse those who curse you, he tells Abraham. I will bless those who bless you, but I will curse those who curse you. And in this particular case, Pharaoh is feeling that. Thus, the Egyptians made Israel's lives bitter. And of course, this is one of the facts that is remembered in the Passover is the bitter herbs that would be put, for instance, when Jesus offers the sop to Judas. It's bread and then it's meat, but it's also bitter herbs in there. And then he dips the sop and gives it to him. But those bitter herbs are a reminder of the horrific treatment that they endured under Pharaoh's hard hand. So the emphasis of verses 8 through 14 falls on the ruthlessness of the work and the slave and servant work imposed on Israel. And of course, this is done over time, their freedoms being eroded over time. Let's look at verses 15 through 22 as time is getting away from us here. Verse 15, chapter 1, Exodus, New King James. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shiphrah, and the name of the other was Puah. Verse 16, and he said, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, then you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. Verse 17, but the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. Verse 18, so the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive? Verse 19, and the midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them. That's a classic line. Verse 20, therefore God dealt well with the midwives and the people multiplied and grew very mighty. Verse 21, and so it was, because the midwives feared God, that he provided households for them. Verse 22, so Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. So in verse 15, these two midwives, they probably represented all midwives, because we have an enormous group of Israelites and there are a lot of children being born. And so as representatives, whether they were Egyptian or they were Hebrew midwives, there were probably, Pharaoh went to them and told them what they needed to do. And verse 16, this is just straight up an awful command to perform. Some commentators believe that the stones that they were sitting on, or, you know, as they were delivering children, would have been used to kill these babes. I don't know, but bottom line, this is really, really awful. Verses 17 through 21, the midwives feared God more than they feared the king of Egypt. So if the midwives were Hebrew women, the fear of God was then a response of faith, just as Abraham's act of offering Isaac had been a response to the command of God in Genesis. So faith demonstrated what was already in their hearts. So if they were truly Hebrew midwives, if they were Egyptian midwives, then it's an act of common grace, or they saw the testimony of the Hebrews or what have you. But anyway, they didn't do it. And even though these women lied to Pharaoh in verse 19, they're praised for their outright refusal to take infant lives. So the Bible presenting the facts as they are. Their reverence for life reflected a reverence for God. Thus, God gave them houses or families or households, whatever the however the word is translated. Same in other Testament, Old Testament books, they were blessed for their actions. That's the bottom line. Finally, the end of the chapter, we have verse 22, kind of a single concluding and transitional verse. It acts as a summary here. Pharaoh now needed to openly command by decree. If they wouldn't do it, now he's got to pass this kind of national law. All his people were made agents of this crime. He kind of deputized the nation in order to try to undo this divine work that God was doing in increasing the Hebrew children. Here, the parallel is to Herod's actions at the birth of Christ. And so we have what commentators call the third pogrom beginning, or the third purge in Exodus 1. Actually, it should be the second purge. So the first time it's the midwives, then a decree by Pharaoh. Either way, Pharaoh's intent on slowing, attacking the Israelites here and slowing divine progression. And of course, he can't really do that. I'd like to show the Bible Project video on this. Will cover the first 18 chapters of Exodus. There's also a second one would take us later part of the book. And I'm just going to activate that now, and that should take us right to about 10, about quarter to eight at this point. So do you have any sound, Jim? Okay.
Yeah, but it should be on his. If he's showing the video.
I'm sorry?
You couldn't hear anything.
That happened last time. That's why I was wondering, Jim, if you had any sound. You know what would be best? Could you play the video yourself and project it for the people there?
Sure.
Just go on to YouTube, look up the Bible Project Exodus, and you will find it. It's very pretty popular video.
Jim, the address is right there on the Bible Project.
Can you see it?
Jim?
Yeah.
It's really light.
Yeah.
Did you find it? Now, for some reason, I can't.
Ray, when you click the link, it will open in a browser. And you're not sharing the browser, you're sharing the PowerPoint. So.
Okay. I used the hyperlink. Okay. So that's probably the best option for us tonight. I'll have to improve on that the next time. By the way, the next two Exodus chapters will be done by Juanes the next 2 weeks, but we'll try to improve on that. Are you able to do it, Jim?
Story of the Exodus begins. Now that name refers to the event that takes place in the first half of the book, Israel's Exodus from Egypt.
Okay, I'm going to play mine then.
I'm good here. Just a minute here. I need you to stop sharing so I can share.
I'm sorry. What did you say?
I got it.
Okay, so I'm going to play it on mine then. You play it on yours, and then I think we should have coverage then. Okay?
Well, I've got it here.
So
Abraham's grandson, Jacob, leading his large family of 70 people down to Egypt. Now, Jacob's 11th son, Joseph, had been elevated to second in command over Egypt, and he had saved his whole family and family. And so Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, offered the family to come live there as a safe haven. And so eventually Jacob dies there in Egypt, and Joseph and all his brothers do too. About 400 years pass, and the story of the Exodus begins. Now, that name refers to the event that takes place in the first half of the book, Israel's Exodus from Egypt. But the book has a second half that takes place at the foot of Mount Sinai. In this video, we'll just focus on the first half, where centuries have passed, and the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied, and they filled the land. Now, this line is a deliberate echo back to the blessing that God gave all humanity back in the Garden of Eden. And it reminds us of the big biblical story so far. Humanity forfeited God's blessing through sin and rebellion, and so God chose Abraham's family as the vehicle through which he would restore his blessing to all the world. But the new Pharaoh does not view Israel as a blessing. He actually thinks this growing Israelite immigrant group is a threat to his power. And so just as in Genesis, humanity rebels against God's blessing, so here, Pharaoh attempts to destroy the source of God's blessing, the Israelites. He brutally enslaves them in forced labor, and then he orders that all the Israelite boys be drowned in the Nile River. Now, Pharaoh, he is the worst character in the Bible so far. His kingdom epitomizes humanity's rebellion against God. Pharaoh has so redefined good and evil according to his own interests that even the murder of innocent children has become good to him. And so Egypt has become worse than Babylon from the book of Genesis. And so now Israel cries out for help against this new Babylon, and God responds. God first turns Pharaoh's evil upside down as an Israelite mother throws her boy into the Nile River, but in a basket. And so he floats safely right down into Pharaoh's own family. He's named Moses, and he grows up to eventually become the man that God will use to defeat Pharaoh's evil. In the famous story of the burning bush, God appears to Moses and commissions him to go to Pharaoh and order him to release the Israelites. And God says that he knows Pharaoh will resist, and so he will bring his judgment on Egypt in the form of plagues. Then God also says that he will harden Pharaoh's heart. And so we're introduced into the next main part of the story, the confrontation between God and Pharaoh. Now, what does this mean that God says he'll harden Pharaoh's heart? It's super important to read this section of the story really closely and in sequence. In Moses and Pharaoh's first encounter, we're told simply that Pharaoh's heart grew hard. There's no implication that God did anything. And so in response, God sends the first set of five plagues, each one confronting Pharaoh and one of his Egyptian gods. And each time, Moses offers a chance for Pharaoh to humble himself and to let the Israelites go. But after each plague, we're told that Pharaoh either hardened his heart or that his heart grew hard. He's doing this of his own will. And so eventually, it's with the second set of five plagues that we begin to hear how God hardened Pharaoh's heart. So the point of the story seems to be this. Even though God knew that Pharaoh would resist his will, God still offered him all these chances to do the right thing. But eventually, Pharaoh's evil reaches a point of no return. I mean, even his own advisors think that he's lost his mind. And it's at that point that God takes over and bends Pharaoh's evil towards his own redemptive purposes. God lures Pharaoh into his own destruction as he saves his people, which is what happens next. With the final plague, it's the night of Passover, and God turns the tables on Pharaoh. Just as he killed the sons of the Israelites, so God will kill the firstborn in Egypt with a final plague. But unlike Pharaoh, God provides a means of escape through the blood of the lamb. And here the story stops and introduces us in detail to the annual Israelite ritual of Passover. On the night before Israel left Egypt, they sacrificed a young, spotless lamb and painted its blood on the doorframe of their house. And when the divine plague came over Egypt, the houses covered with the blood of the lamb were passed over and the sun spared. And so every year since, the Israelites have reenacted that night to remember and to celebrate God's justice and his mercy. But Pharaoh, because of his pride and rebellion, he loses his own son. And he's compelled to finally let the Israelites go free. And so the Israelite slaves make their exodus from Egypt. But no sooner do they leave that Pharaoh changes his mind. And he gathers his army and chases after the Israelites for a final shipment. As the Israelites pass through the waters of the sea safely, Pharaoh charges towards his own destruction. The Exodus story concludes with the first song of praise in the Bible. It's called the Song of the Sea. And the final line declares that the Lord reigns as king. And then the song retells in poetry what the story of God's kingdom is all about. It's about how God is on a mission to confront evil in his world and to redeem those who are enslaved to evil. God is going to bring his people into the promised land where his divine presence will live among them. This story is what it looks like when God becomes king over his people. So after the Israelites sing their song, the story takes a sharp turn. The Israelites are trekking through the wilderness on their way to Mount Sinai, and they're hungry, they're thirsty, and they start criticizing Moses and God for even rescuing them. They say they long for the good old days in Egypt. I mean, it's crazy. So God graciously provides food and water for Israel in the wilderness, but these stories, they cast a dark shadow. And we begin to wonder, could it be that Israel's heart is just as hard as Pharaoh's? We shall see. But for now, that's the first half of the book of Exodus.
Okay. Thank you for your attention. We'll turn it back over to Fred then.
The book of Exodus